Welcome to That's a Dive. I'm Kyle Martino. What is up, Tad Potters? We're back in the studio. I've got PJ next to me, and we're trying to distract ourselves from the fact that there's an international break coming up, an international break that, although we're never really looking forward to them because we missed the Premier League, we're looking forward to this one because it has huge implications. We're on the working end of qualifying. It's business time, and the U.S. have two very, very big games. So we'll get into the topics in a moment. We've got three good ones for today that involve U.S. The U.S. team. But I'm going to jump into these reviews. Again, Tad Potters, thanks for the reviews. It helps. I still haven't figured out why, but it helps. I know that. That's the part that I have figured out. But what I'm going to do, though, is because it's awkward for me to read nice things said about myself. You know, no one wants to brag about themselves, although Jorge's laughing at me right now because he knows that I do want to brag about myself. But I'm going to curb that desire and save us some time to just read the soccer moments because the soccer moments are awesome. I love this idea that we have of you giving the reviews and adding that soccer moment that hooked you, the moment that you knew this was the game for you and you were going to follow it. And this week, there are a couple in here that some I didn't know and refresh my memory. And one that tells us probably this is my oldest listener. And I'm going to read his first. And this is by Old Tim Err. I mean, he gives the clue already in his name. His soccer moment is, as for what lured me into becoming a soccer fan, instead of one moment, it was the full 12-year run of a PBS TV show launched more than 40 years ago, Soccer Made in Germany. So I was born in 81, so this show started before I was born. But I remember people talking about this show. So this is what hooked Old Tim. Soccer Made in Germany. Each week, the show condensed a Bundesliga game into 60 minutes. The broadcaster was the inimitable Toby Charles, who to my ear set a standard never matched since. Soccer Made in Germany provided my introduction to high-level European football, and I've been a stalwart fan ever since. Soccer Made in Germany.
Did you ever watch it, or you just heard about it?
No, I remember hearing about it. We're going to have to Google that when we get off. I'm sure YouTube's got some
Googled
gems.
It real quick. He said it was a 12-year run, 1976 to 1988. So it shows you the game was being covered here even back in the 70s and 80s.
Soccer Made in Germany. I love it. I bet the graphics or, you know, the open, it's amazing. Like Atari quality, amazing. The next one from Shawnee PL. I first fell in love with the game watching Ronaldinho highlights with my brother on YouTube. This is our first person falling in love with watching highlights on YouTube. Also, not sure what you can do about the back injury, Kyle. I didn't realize those existed once the transfer window shut. That's so good. Yeah.
How is the back, by the way? I don't think you updated in the last podcast.
The back's doing better. It's not doing as good as Coutinho and the others that have had bad backs recently, as he was alluding to. But it's definitely doing better. All right, last one. Grizzlies. Followed soccer all my life. My favorite soccer moment is Torsten Frings' goal against Costa Rica in the opening game of 2006 World Cup. I was 10 at the time, and it was one of the earliest memories seeing it on TV. Plus, Balak's celebration just had me laughing. Okay, I can't believe we didn't Google or YouTube Balak's celebration. I wonder what it was.
Well, I was just going to say that person clearly, he said he was 10 years old in the 2006 World Cup, so he must have been 6 in 2002, and he must have not been watching, because otherwise I don't think he'd be a big fan of Torsten Frings in the 2002 World Cup.
At least Torsten has come clean and said that he did handle the ball and that they were lucky to win that game. But it doesn't stop us from just having PTSD about that moment. And that brings us to, hopefully we don't have another terrible moment where the U.S. are robbed, because they have two... I want to call them must-win games. Obviously, the math doesn't work that way. They have two games. One of them is definitely must-win. The other is must-perform. 4 points will look really good for the U.S., but they should come into these thinking they have to perform. They have to win. We're going to talk about the World Cup roster. Bruce Arena has named the men that are going to try and get the United States to the World Cup in Russia. A game versus Panama on Friday night, a game at Trinidad and Tobago on Tuesday night are all that stand between the United States and a World Cup berth. So we'll get into that. The next topic, Harry Kane. The guy just keeps doing it. And the debate that's going on that I saw the two Robbies have on the show this weekend is he world class? Is Harry Kane world class? We're going to talk about that. But first, let's talk about Manchester City, a team that is world class, and what a world class performance they put on at Stamford Bridge. So, obviously, reigning champions, Stamford Bridge, a very tough place to go. Although, don't tell that to Sean Dyche right out of the gate this year. Him and his Burnley team, obviously, against a depleted squad, a Chelsea team that started slow, and then obviously tough to play with nine men. But anyway, you don't go to Stamford Bridge and do to Chelsea what Manchester City just did to them. And the scoreline won't tell you that, but the performance will. I mean, it was a... They broke Chelsea down by attrition. I mean, it was relentless. The possession, the probing, the pressing, the just irresistible fluidity of the game. Manchester City, it looked unstoppable. And there were large parts of the game where Chelsea were doing their best to keep them at bay, doing their best to stymie them, to stop them. And it just eventually took on a feeling around the hour mark where there was a 15-minute stretch where you thought, there's no way. There's no way Manchester City don't score. And they obviously eventually get the breakthrough through the player of the year in the Premier League so far, I think Kevin De Bruyne. Obviously, Lukaku and others will make claims and we'll be up there, and there will be a great debate as we go throughout the season on who is the early favorite for Premier League Player of the Year. But Kevin De Bruyne just comes up with a huge goal and a huge moment and was central to so many things that went well for Manchester City. This is nothing new. Manchester City started last season in a dominant fashion, right? They won the first 10 games, all competitions. The difference this time, PJ, is I remember Pep's face and his sort of demeanor after a lot of those performances where he seemed dissatisfied. There was a sense of he was trying to curb the enthusiasm that the press had for his team. Everyone was talking about trebles. I mean, some people were talking about quadruples.
I think he said quadruple, yeah.
Yeah. And he was trying to shut that down because he knew they were imperfect. He knew there were issues. He knew they hadn't really perfected what they were trying to do. And most people in the media read that as and began to write articles when things fell apart. So Pep was very prescient in knowing they weren't the complete product. Many people pointed to the defensive frailties. But I honestly think what Pep meant, and I'm not reading too much into it, he sort of said this verbatim, he was upset with how profligate they were in front of goal. He was upset that he thought they were dominant enough, they created enough chances to outscore their defensive frailties. So the return of a irresistible attacking side that was excellent even without their best striker, Sergio Aguero. I mean, he had that very strange incident of 48 hours before the game, going to a concert in Amsterdam, got into a car accident, riding in a taxi. I think he ended up with a broken rib, so it wasn't available for the game. I mean, that could have been a massive distraction before the game, but also a massive loss to lose Sergio Aguero. As good as Gabriel Jesus is and continues to be, you want definitely both of them out there if you can, as we've seen through the beginning of the year. So the fact that they were still as dominant without him is impressive, but they're ruthless in the final third. So that's changed, but so many other things have changed that make them a more complete team. They press better. So we didn't really see them press well last year. It was actually one of the reasons he and Sergio Aguero, Pep Guardiola and Sergio Aguero, got into a couple of early tough discussions. I remember when his agent flew in and they went out to dinner and were pictured out at a restaurant, and Sergio got dropped from the team and speculation on him moving in the summer was created. And Pep basically said, I just expect more from him. And what he meant was not scoring goals. He's done that at an amazing clip since he's been there. He meant, I need my first defender to be my striker, and we need to press. We need to join. We need to make teams uncomfortable when we have prolonged possession. They're doing that. They're winning the ball back in the opposition's final third. They're creating goal-scoring opportunities out of that. But the other thing that's doing is making them less susceptible in transition. But inevitably, this is Liverpool's problem. The press is going to get broken. They're going to be able to breach that. The next line of defense, whether it be Fernandinho, or even Kevin De Bruyne
and David Silva
with how hard they work back. But more importantly, the back line of John Stones is improving as a positional defender in his decision-making. Otamendi's not going to ground as often as he did. Ederson's very quick off his line. Their fullbacks are remarkably fast. Mendy got hurt, so this was Delph in this game, which actually I'll get onto in a second, mm-hmm. which brings up another interesting conversation about them. They're just balanced while maintaining the risky attacking style that Pep loves so much. So it's starting to look like a Bayern Munich team, a Barcelona team, obviously with different nuances, with slight tweaks here and there, but it's looking dominant in the ways that he's made teams dominant in the past. So they're picking up what he's putting down. And I think this performance at Stamford Bridge was the biggest statement game in his tenure that he's going to be successful trying to get them to play the way that he wants them to play, in a way commensurate with the teams he's been successful coaching in the past.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers are pretty impressive defensively. They've had six straight clean sheets if you take out their one League Cup game, which, you know, who cares? So in the Premier League and in the Champions League, six straight clean sheets for a Pep Guardiola side that is always criticized for being too offensive-minded, mm-hmm. but defensively he's getting it done. Last year at this point, through seven matches, they'd already conceded seven goals. I think he only had two clean sheets. They've only conceded two goals in the first seven matches so far this season. So defensively, it's working too. Yeah. And everybody thought, you know, you need to adapt. You need to change your system, become more defensive-minded. And he hasn't done that. Like you said, I think he's finally found that way to kind of perfect the system he wants to execute with the team.
It was a personnel issue in that, you know, spending remarkable amounts of money on younger, better caliber defenders makes you a better defensive team. I mean, of course, that's simple to understand. But all those other things that I talked about, they weren't really going to be able to be a good defensive team if they weren't as potent in attack as they need to be. I mean, that pushes teams back. That makes teams uncomfortable. I mean, one of the reasons Chelsea were so poor in transition, obviously they lose Morata and they struggled because they didn't replace him with Batshuayi, who they don't trust yet. They still don't have Diego Costa, which still baffles me. I understand, and I talked about it in a podcast, I understand the friction. I understand Diego Costa in January did something unforgivable in Conte's eyes, but he's been doing unforgivable things under the previous managers, and they were able to clear it up. All he wanted to do was go to Atletico Madrid. I mean, couldn't it have been easy to say to him, okay, you can go. We're going to sell you, but we need you. You're not going to start because Morata's our guy. We need you until January. Stay fit. Be ready for us to put him into that to this game. And by the way, now the news that Morata's hamstring injury could keep him out mm-hmm. for an extended period, they don't trust Batshuayi. So it'd be nice to have Diego Costa now. Yeah. Sorry, a little bit of a tangent. But Chelsea couldn't be good at what they're great at because Manchester City were relentless in how they attacked them. So that's kind of how Pep defends. I know it sounds like a cliche, but he defends with the ball. And he also defends with his six-second philosophy of winning it back 6 seconds at most after they lose it. So they're good at that. And one reason that they can really commit to that press is because when it's breached, as I said before, he can trust his defenders to defend 1v1. And he couldn't do that before. He could do that at his other clubs. He couldn't do that at Manchester City last season. And then tiny little nuances. I've mentioned before that when he was at Bayern Munich, he sort of twisted his mustache and hatched an evil plot to bring his fullbacks into the center of the field, in Alaba and Lahm, and create overload centrally, and everyone was just baffled and couldn't understand how to combat that. He tried it initially, and it wasn't working at Manchester City. One thing he's done recently is he's brought Stones, when they play in a back four, out of that back four into midfield to create those overloads, and Fernandinho will sort of withdraw and watch that. What he did with Fabian Delph, a lot of people criticize that to say, listen, you spend all of this money on defenders and you're putting a central midfielder at left back, forgetting the fact that Alaba is a center midfielder. I mean, that's what he plays for his country. That's actually who he is. And he was turned into a left back who could be a central midfielder a lot of the times because they possess the ball so well. So in Delph, he kind of has that ability that he didn't have with Clichy, that he didn't have with Kolarov, that he didn't have with Sanya. All these other fullbacks that he tried that with, Zabaleta, couldn't really perform it like Delph obviously can if he can just figure out the sort of defensive responsibilities of playing in the back line. So it just shows that he has another arrow, right? He has another He has another way to keep you guessing, to make it challenging to play against Manchester City. So I think, and I said this on the last podcast, Manchester United, Manchester City, the two most dominant teams so far in the league, and I think on that podcast only alphabetical order was separating them. I mean, the numbers were exactly the same. I said Manchester City seems to me to be closer to the complete version of a Pep team than Manchester United appears to be closer to a version of a Mourinho team. Although I know it was Crystal Palace, Mourinho and Manchester United put in another fantastic performance. So the good part is, even if I believe Manchester City are a little bit further along, Manchester United are not far behind. So hopefully we get that mouthwatering battle between these guys down the stretch.
December 9th, yep. Well, Manchester United has their first big test coming up right after international break, Liverpool. That's going to be – we'll start to find out more if Manchester United is really there.
So Manchester City have had to pass some big tests already, and that Chelsea one was one of the bigger ones. Manchester United haven't been forced to pass many big tests. I mean, in preseason, Real Madrid was their last big test, and that one didn't go great. Even though they haven't passed big tests, Manchester United look like they're primed to pass those tests. So I'm optimistic that they're going to perform well and they will pass those tests, but it creates a great scenario where we're still waiting to learn more about Manchester United, and we've already learned a lot about Manchester City. We've also learned a lot about our next topic, Harry Kane. I remember it. PJ, I remember when he came on the scene, right? He was playing Europa League games. He wasn't getting his chances. And because, was it Soldado at the time? I mean, I can't remember. I think it was. He was struggling to score. Mm-hmm. And that was the guy that they brought in. He had scored boatloads of goals in La Liga and was brought in to be their guy. And he couldn't do it. He couldn't become the guy. And so he was given a chance, Harry Kane, and started scoring right from the offset. First, he started scoring in Europa League. And then it transferred to the Premier League. And I remember after that first season, everyone said, can he do it again? I mean, it's kind of the same thing that's the debate that goes on with Jamie Vardy. And it seems like the people that thought Jamie Vardy couldn't, it's coming to fruition. But many were saying, yeah, one season wonder, it's not going to happen. You know, he's not going to be able to keep scoring goals. I mean, he keeps doing it. He keeps doing it. So for me, this whole debate of is he world class? Of course he's world class. I just, the hardest thing to do in the game is score goals, right? And Harry Kane does that every season for Spurs on a level commensurate with people that we call world class. So I mean, let me throw some of these numbers at you for this is 2017. I mean, this is this year, and we could go back further, but let's keep it, you know, recent. In September, he had 11 goals in 6 matches. Yeah, that's decent.
That's not bad.
But let's just look at other players that would fall into the world-class category and that I always hear people say are world-class. Messi, 43 games, 45 goals. Kane, 31 games, 36 goals. Cavani, 38 games, 36 goals. Lewandowski, 34 games, 35 goals. Ronaldo, 34 games, 31 goals. I mean, his goals per game is only bettered by probably the best person to ever play the game.
It's actually better. His is better.
Oh, it's better. Yeah. Oh, I was reading the wrong line.
The order was by the number of goals scored, but his goals per game is actually better than Messi's in the calendar year of 2017.
And that'd be one thing if this was a one-off, but he keeps doing this. Mm-hmm. And also, it's the range and variety of his goals. I mean, he can score creating a shot for himself. He can score long distance, amazing strike from outside of the box. He can score curling efforts from tough angles. He can score headers. He can score flicks. He can score right. He can score left. He got a perfect hat trick like a week or so ago. Yep. So he kind of, to me, falls into the category of, probably because they're English, but of like Wayne Rooney and Alan Shearer, other guys that have done it at a remarkable level with remarkable consistency that don't get to join this club of being world class. And I don't get it. I think all three of those guys are world class. I think Wayne Rooney's world class. You don't become the all-time leading goal scorer for a country who's won a World Cup. For a team that's the most successful team in English soccer, without being world class. Mm-hmm. You know, Alan Shearer, what he did at Newcastle, you don't do that without being world class. I mean, again, I'll go back to it. Scoring goals is the hardest thing to do in the game of soccer, which is why guys that score goals are going for hundreds of millions of dollars. Harry Kane scores goals just as good as world-class players. So he has to be world-class.
I was going to ask, do you have a – the term world-class gets thrown around so much. I just wonder if you have a specific definition, because obviously defenders and midfielders might fall other than scoring goals.
You know,
but is it, do you have anything that you actually think this player needs to do this, this, and this to officially become world-class?
Well, I guess,
or is it just sort of like an eye test thing?
What people are going to say is they're going to say the numbers don't make someone world-class. I mean, that's what becomes tough, is it's such an arbitrary marker, is that I think world-class is more of an eye test, right? So, you know, the Zidanes of the world are world-class even if their goals and assists aren't better than other people not considered world-class. You know, like Mesut Ozil is one of those ones. I mean, Mesut Ozil continues to fall into this debate where I consider him to be world-class because of his composure, his ability on the ball, his ability to play for any team in the world. There's no level above his talent. And it, you know, people are more willing to give Mesut Ozil a world-class designation than Harry Kane, I think, because it just passes the eye test better. I honestly think that's what world-class is. And you don't want to make the mistake of just passing this out nilly-willy to anyone, right? I think it diminishes what that means. And it's obviously a very, very exclusive group. But it can't be so exclusive that there are only two or three guys in it. I mean, what's the point of having a class that only Messi, Ronaldo, and maybe one or two other guys fall in? So I just think the qualifications for it are so vague, and also it create a scenario that's so hard to qualify for that many guys that deserve to be in the category aren't. And I think Harry Kane deserves to be in the world-class category. If he did it for one season, I would say, I want to wait. But the fact that he does it consistently, and by the way, can do it for any club in the world. I mean, there is no club in the world where Harry Kane can't be a starting presence. I mean, there's no club in the world where he's not going to get into a team. So if that doesn't make you world class, then I just don't know what does.
I guess, you know, for people that would probably put Ozil over Kane, they might look at the fact that he's won league titles, he's won a World Cup. Does Harry Kane need to start doing some of that? I mean, it's hard to make those direct comparisons because Mesut Ozil played for Real Madrid and he played for Germany. He played for two of the, you know, arguably one of the best club teams in the world, and also one of the best international teams in the world in Germany. So, you know, it's those direct. I don't think those direct comparisons are always fair. Especially, I mean, imagine if Harry Kane leads Tottenham to a Premier League title when they haven't won one since the 1960s, I believe, or first division title.
You know, that debate, it happens in every sport, right? LeBron James wasn't going to be thought of as sort of the basketball caliber of world class until he won something, and you know. It's the reason it's that's a specious argument is that, yeah, that seems about right. You know, if you're world class, you should be winning trophies. But like, you know, I think Ryan Giggs was world class, but because he chose to play for Wales, he you're going to blame him for not winning a World Cup. But okay, so he wins for Manchester United and he wins at the club level. So you'll let him sneak into that category. I think Steven Gerrard is world class, but. You know, he never won a World Cup, never won a Premier League title. I mean, there are guys that I just feel like, you know, maybe I'm just being more liberal and more inclusive of that category, and maybe I should protect the prestige of that category more. But I just think Harry Kane might not look on a day where you're out there watching a game. You might not pick him out like you pick out a Ronaldo, the Brazilian Ronaldo, who, mm-hmm. who I still kind of hold as the real Ronaldo, as good as Cristiano is, and he's phenomenal. But like, you know, and Cruyff and Platini and Socrates and Maradona, and I mean all of these guys that you throw into this category, within like a minute of watching them play, you see them ooze world class quality. Eric Cantona, all these guys that just have a bravado and a mastery of the game. That just it feels and looks different. Harry Kane doesn't have that sort of je ne sais quoi, right? He doesn't have that where like you watch a game and you think, man, who is that? Mm-hmm. But if you watch him enough, you think, wow, scoring goals are hard. Scoring goals is hard, and I don't see too many guys doing it more often than this guy.
I was going to bring that up because when you watch Harry Kane, sometimes he's sort of almost awkward. He just kind of, he's a little like clunky. Like, you know, everything he does works. Like, but it's just when you watch him, it doesn't always look smooth. When you watch, you know, you look at Cristiano. He's basically the perfect specimen for a soccer player. You watch Messi. He takes guys one on one. He plays these beautiful passes. And look at Zidane. He does things with the ball that we've never seen before. You don't see that with Harry Kane, or at least not. You don't see it. It doesn't look as graceful as it does with some of those other players. And I think that hurts him. It's just like he's not as aesthetically pleasing for people to watch.
And what's amazing about that is end product is all that matters. So, like, he scored a goal, right, where he took the ball between two defenders, back to the goal, one tiny little drop of the shoulder swivel, creates separation so that he can get a shot off and hits it from well outside the box with his left foot. All of that is incredibly difficult to do, but because, to your point, it doesn't involve a more sort of flamboyant and stylistic sort of movement, it's almost downgraded, when in reality it doesn't matter if he turned and put it through that guy's legs or did a double step over, or just, you know, like Zidane did moves that don't need the sort of the spectacular step over, that are so smooth and so good he just glides by guys. I mean, yeah, because he doesn't have that, he just executed a remarkable moment, scored a beautiful goal, and it doesn't get to be sort of in the museum of beautiful goals, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, just real quick question before we wrap up on him. Does he need to improve his performance with England? Does he need to have a breakout performance in the World Cup coming up? His goal record's not that bad. 10 goals in 21 matches, but no goals in Euro 2016. Does he need to basically light it up in Russia?
That's the only argument that I think holds water, is to say, and this is the one always thrown out at Wayne Rooney. But, you know, for Wayne Rooney, whether it be injuries or other sort of mitigating circumstances, an inability to transfer great club performance to the international level and in a big tournament specifically, because Harry Kane's done it in friendlies, he's done it in qualifiers, to do it when it matters, that ends up being the biggest demonstration of world-class talent. So that's the one area where I'll sort of digress and say, okay, you've got a good point that he hasn't done it consistently enough. Listen, I'm not saying that it's only if he wins a World Cup or wins the Euros that he's going to be world class, because I already don't feel that that's true. I debunked that before. But if you say, listen, he's not scoring goals, he's not leading the team in major tournaments, if that's happening regularly, then yeah, I think that's a good excuse for not putting him in a world class category.
And again, in his defense, he's only played in one major tournament so far, so he's going to have many opportunities. Hopefully.
We'll see, because he's going to be leading the line at the next World Cup for England. Who's going to be leading the line in the next World Cup for the U.S.? And are the U.S. even going to be in the next World Cup? That question is out there, and there are two games in the next week that will answer it. So we know who is lining up to try and get the U.S. to the World Cup. And that's the first big discussion, is Bruce has announced his roster, and it is trying to think of the way to put it. It's domestic, more domestic than previous lineups have been, in terms of trusting guys that play locally, trusting guys that have been with him for a long time, and trusting aging guys that many think there are guys playing abroad that are better than. You know, if you're going to distill that down to one example, not bringing Fabian Johnson and bringing DeMarcus Beasley as an easy sort of one-off example of that. Obviously, you can include other names in that. You know, many people will look at that, and many people have and texted me, or I've seen it on Twitter, and said, "What is Bruce thinking? Why is he doing this?" My answer to that is, I'm not as shocked by the team that he selected. That there are the Giassi Zardeses, that the Benny Failhybers, the Juan Agudelos, the DeMarcus Beasleys, as I've just said. I'm not surprised that a lot of these guys are coming back into the picture, because I think what it is, Bruce is demonstrating short-term pragmatism. He knows what to expect from certain guys in certain situations. He knows what it's going to take. He's been here before to get performances and results in the next two games, the most important being the home game against Panama. That's an absolute must-win. He knows that he doesn't need the best. He doesn't need the best players in terms of individual talent. How are you playing for your club team and you know, how good are you? How talented are you? He needs a group that can get together and trust they're going to outcompete and outperform two teams that they should. So obviously the challenge of playing on the road in Trinidad and Tobago is a different one than playing at home at Panama. But basically Bruce is saying, guys that I've been able to get it out of in the past, guys that know what playing against this type of team, these type of players, I want those guys. I want the guys that have been in the locker room together a lot, that have a bond, that have an understanding, that have a reliability in terms of I believe I can get their best. Now, their best might not be as good as other players' best, but the challenge with those other players is Bruce, just based on working with them in the short time, isn't sure he can get the best out of them, and also isn't sure getting the best out of them is what's best for the U.S. team. And I hear all the debates about moving forward in the World Cup, and listen, I don't think this roster is indicative of what he's thinking for the World Cup. I just think he's looking at two games and saying, I need to go back to, and the U.S. needs to go back to, who they are in these moments of must win against teams you regularly beat. And I think with the roster he has a team that should beat Panama on Friday night. And we're trying to get a really good interview, and I'm not gonna tell you who, but we've got a couple of great interviews lined up, like we did with Tim Howard before their last qualifiers, that maybe we can get out this week. But one reason we couldn't do it today is they are working tirelessly on individual positioning and team movement and making sure that everyone knows their role. Everyone is a part of the game plan to get performances and get results in two important games. Individual meetings are taking place. I mean, Bruce and Tim said this on the podcast when we spoke to him, and go back and listen to that because it was really wonderful, prescient, and interesting conversation with him. I asked him what's changed in Bruce from this time around to last time. He said, well, if you can believe it, he's more relaxed off of the field in terms of the sort of interaction with players, and he's calm and sort of zen-like, but much more detail-oriented than he's been in the past. And that's why I think he's brought in guys that he thinks, for whatever reason, myriad reasons, you know, whether it be lack of ego, lack of profile, lack of playing time, lack of so many things that would be a negative that Bruce is trying to turn into a positive. He sees a bunch of guys that have worked together in the past well, that Bruce understands their motivations and how to get the best out of them. And, you know, like, for instance, I've seen people criticizing, you know, if we're trying to be an attacking-minded team, if we're trying to bring the game to the Christian Pulisics, to get the Woods involved, to get the Josie Altidores involved, if we're trying to push teams back on their heel, why is Michael Bradley left to be one of the only links from defense to attack? It's a lot of pressure to put on him. So I don't know if he's going to start or play regularly, but Benny Failhaber has been the type of player that can do that for the U.S. team. Now he's come in and had a couple bad performances. He's come in and not really taken the chances the best that he can, but he's talented enough to do that. And, you know, had a great Gold Cup where he proved that. And, you know, that is a really stick out name in the roster that people are jumping on in a sort of critical, pejorative way, where I say, listen, I just think Bruce, and if they don't get the results, they don't get the performances, I'm wrong and I'll eat crow. I just look at this roster and I just see a bunch of guys that Bruce knows very well and a bunch of guys that know each other very well. And I think that's what you need in two must-win games in CONCACAF qualifying. Above anything else, you need continuity, you need chemistry, and you need a competitive spirit. And I see it in a lot of the guys picked to come into this camp.
Yeah, chemistry is, I think, is obviously a very important word, and I agree with you about Failhaber. I think maybe aside from Pulisic, he might be the most technically gifted player on the
definitely.
Team. And so he's one of those guys I think you just want to, when we see this team struggle, you want to see him get in there. The one thing I wanted to bring up is we've seen that we saw it during – in June it worked. They had Trinidad and Tobago the first game, and then they played Mexico. He put out almost two completely different lineups mm-hmm. in those games, and it worked. They got the win against Trinidad
and the draw.
And they got the draw in Mexico. Yep. He did something similar this last time against Honduras and Costa Rica. It didn't really work.
Mm-mm.
I remember on the very first podcast we did, which was right after their first set of qualifiers in March, we kind of talked about what does Bruce Arena bring? And the one thing you said was clarity, a clear message, a clear purpose for all these players. And you kind of just went over that again right now, saying mm-hmm. he's going to talk to these guys individually, and they're going to know their role. But when he changes the lineup a lot, and you have different center backs in there, different midfielders, you have Pulisic playing out wide, then he's playing central, mm-hmm. then you've got someone like Graham Zuzi playing as a right back. Does that clear message really sink in, or does it become more difficult to develop that chemistry and sustain it?
I think it creates an issue. I think it can be detrimental to the group when there isn't continuity. And the biggest example I can give of that is, and I've talked about this a lot, is center back positions, right? There haven't been center backs that have played regularly together. And we saw a pairing this last time around of two guys that never played together. So that ends up being one example of, yeah, changing the team a lot does hurt the squad. I think the positive, though, is when you do it at the beginning of camp and you say, and this is sort of in comparison to Jurgen Klinsmann that sometimes didn't announce teams until the day of. When you say that far out, this is how we're going to play, this is what we're going to do, this is your role, and it doesn't work, it's kind of like, all right, that was the bad plan, but at least guys knew what they were supposed to do, right? So I think Bruce deserves a lot of criticism for the Costa Rica plan not working well and not changing it soon enough. You know, Fabian Johnson, by the way, had a terrible, terrible game, and he wasn't one of the guys brought off, and that wasn't a change made. Now he's not in the camp, so maybe that's just lesson learned too late. And I don't mean to pick on Fabian Johnson because he's been excellent at times for the U.S. and he's a very good soccer player. But when you do change the team around a lot, those continuity issues can come up. I just think what's good about how Bruce is doing it is it's just communicated clearly enough where guys are being put in positions that they can succeed in because it's typically the position they play for their club or position they've played regularly for the U.S. They're being told early what's expected of them. They're being told early how you're going to play and set up. So if the game plan doesn't work, it's either the game plan wasn't a good one or you can look at individual players and say you knew what you were supposed to do and you didn't perform. So accountability is there on both sides. There are tactical things that I question about Bruce recently because the U.S. has switched to back three a lot. And that's worked, but they don't start with it a lot and don't seem to trust it moving into important games. So it just that isn't necessarily a bad thing, but just as a flag that raises a question, why, if it's worked so well in game tactical switch wise, have you not sort of tried to use that more regularly? The other one is how to get the best out of Christian Pulisic. So we keep watching Christian Pulisic thrive, and I know it's a different league, it's a different team, it's different personnel, but Borussia Dortmund are as dominant in Bundesliga as the U.S. are in CONCACAF, player to player. So they should be able to, the U.S., dominate with the ball on the ground and bring Christian Pulisic into the game in 1v1 scenarios in wide positions. Now, CONCACAF are going to set up and target Christian Pulisic unlike he gets targeted when he plays for Borussia Dortmund. There's so much talent on that team, you can't really create schemes defensively to focus on Christian Pulisic. But all the more reason to put him on the wing in some of these scenarios where instead of trying to play him in a 4-4-2 diamond at the top or a flat four in the middle or a flat four or diamond off the flank where he doesn't get width, where he doesn't play in these high channels, where he doesn't have the fluidity to get into 1v1 scenarios, where he demonstrates what he's best at, which is beating people off the dribble and bringing others into the game or being a goal-scoring threat. It just baffles me that we haven't seen him utilized yet in that way of playing a 4-3-3. We have the personnel to play that. And that's another area that I just wonder. Christian Pulisic is a star. I don't care how old he is. He's someone we need to depend on. So create a system that unlocks and gets the best out of him. And I just haven't really seen him used yet the way he's used for Borussia Dortmund. And listen, there are excuses for that that I'll say are valid excuses, but not valid enough to have almost never seen it when he comes plays for the U.S. team. So to finish, all I want to see in these games coming up is a good start, is a competitive, cohesive team that believes what is true, that they should beat Panama, that they should get a result in Trinidad and Tobago. None of those things are a given. You have to earn the right to be the better team. But the U.S. is the better team in both of these games. And forget Trinidad and Tobago. The only focus has to be right now. Panama are going to be physical. They're going to be organized. They're going to target Christian Pulisic. They're going to be behind the ball. They're going to play direct. They're going to do all the things that we know Panama can do. And if you sit back and let it happen, like what happened against Costa Rica, Panama grows into a confident team that plays well above their ability when they feel they're starting to take over the game. I mean, they can be a team that can get the ball on the ground and pick apart the U.S. if the United States let them turn into that team. So it's all about the mistake at Red Bull Arena against Costa Rica was a couple of great stretches, some good moments, a great first 10 or 15 minutes, and not capitalizing on that, not continuing to push, and letting fear and doubt creep into that game. And then Costa Rica sensed that, and they're the type of team, the caliber of team, to take it over. Panama could do the same thing in Orlando if the U.S. don't start strong and pummel them, absolutely give them vertigo at the beginning of the game with how relentless the pressure is, the intensity, the fluidity. That all has to happen, because if they start the game scared, if they start the game worried about conceding, then that game can be lost. That game can be lost for sure.
No, definitely. Before we officially wrap up, I'm curious if there's – you don't have to give a full starting 11 or anything like that, but if there's specific players that have come into this team. You know, we already talked about Fellhaber. You know, I think you're talking about Pulisic out wide. I wonder if that's the key. Get someone like Benny Fellhaber in the middle. He kind of handles that creative responsibilities in the middle. You let Pulisic do his thing out wide. I wonder if that could be an interesting sort of setup. I'm just curious about other guys, maybe like DeAndre Yedlin coming back in finally, finally healthy. Maybe there's a center back pairing. I'm just curious, is there any specific
Let me give you my dream lineup.
Okay.
And then I'll give more of what I think Bruce will go for. So my dream lineup of what I want to see is I want to see Tim Howard in goal. I want to see DeAndre Yedlin at right back. I want to see Jeff Cameron at right center back. I want to see Matt Beisler at left center back, and I want to see Viafana at left back. That's how I want them to start in the back line. I want to see Michael Bradley playing the holding role with Kellen Acosta a little bit more free to kind of get forward and contribute, and Benny Fellhaber a little bit sort of kind of further forward of him. So a reverse, sort of an inverted triangle.
So you think like a 4-2-3-1 for the midfield?
More sort of 4-1.
Gotcha.
I'm okay with it looking 4-2-3-1 if they're not possessing the ball, but I do want Acosta to have freedom to get forward and be the more sort of two-way box-to-box midfielder that can help out.
So he would be that sort of flexible player depending on the game. So it might be a 4-1-4-1 or 4-2-3-1 if you drop him back.
I'd like to see kind of like Manchester City play with Fernandinho holding and Kevin De Bruyne and David Silva getting forward. Obviously less so than David Silva does. But also capable of holding when Michael Bradley goes on his forays, because I don't want to lock Michael Bradley out of contributing in the final third because he's very good at coming late. Then I want to see a top three of – I bounce back and forth between – because both of them should play. I want to see Jozy Altidore in the middle. I know everyone's going to be screaming Bobby Wood at me. I want to see Christian Pulisic off the left and Darlington Nagby off the right. I want to see a 4-3-3 like that. That's how I think the U.S. should set up, and I think they'd be dominant in that. I think you have pace and one-on-one ability in the wide positions with two players that are also very adept at coming centrally, creating overloads, finding little lanes, especially on the right with Nagby, who's played centrally a lot more. Give him the freedom to tuck in, knowing Yedlin is excellent at overlapping. I love that midfield can possess the ball. People will say Benny Fellhaber is a defensive liability. I don't think so. I think he's going to be playing with a chip on his shoulder. He's going to show that he deserves to be in this group, that he's wanted to be a part of it for a long time and feels robbed of that opportunity. So I think there's plenty of playmaking ability in there. There's possession ability. There's composure. There's tempo. There's range while still having a group that can combat and tackle and close down passing lanes and press the ball And then that back line, I think, is Matt Beisler together with Tim Ream are two of the best playing out of that left back position. Best on the ball playing out of the back. I think Matt Beisler is just a better defender by a little bit. I think Jeff Cameron gives you presence. He's been the most consistent center back recently, even if he has his moments of lapses. And Tim Howard is a leader and our best goalkeeper. So that's how I'd like to see it. How I think he's going to go is I think he's going to go Tim Howard. He's going to go back line of DeAndre Yedlin, Jeff Cameron. I'm guessing maybe Omar Gonzalez and DeMarcus Beasley. I wouldn't be surprised if he does that, because why bring in these old guys that you trust that you know really well if he's not going to use them in the most important game? Then I think he's going to go Michael Bradley as a holder. You know what? I think he's going to play it flat. I think he's going to play Michael Bradley with Kellen Acosta. He's going to play Christian Pulisic off the right, and he's going to play Alejandro Bedoya kind of leftish, and then he's going to go with Wood and Altidore. That's what I think he's going to do. Based on kind of my history with Bruce and seeing this team, I wouldn't be surprised if he goes that way. And then obviously it has the fluidity of moving around and becoming a sort of different version of that. At least with that, you can move into a 4-3-3 by pushing Pulisic up and sliding Bedoya into a central position that he's comfortable with. So you don't have to burn a substitution if you want to make a tactical change. But, you know, who knows? We'll see. Whoever lines up, I'm confident that they can get
the 3 points.
Get the 3 points, and that's all that matters. It doesn't matter what it looks like. It doesn't matter who's out there. Whoever's out there, is going, based on this roster, is going to be a better 11 than the 11 they're going to face. But if they think that's going to get the win, they're going to be sorely mistaken, because there's a Panama team that has done it before and will do it again that can surprise the United States. So we'll see. Did I sell it that I'm not nervous? I mean, are people buying that?
I think this is the most nervous a lot of U.S. soccer fans have been in a while. I mean, if we don't qualify, this is the first time since 1986 that we will not have qualified for the World Cup, which is
I'm nervous. I think I'm demonstrating some a little bit of false bravado, because it's almost wishful thinking. Like, it's unimaginable us not going to a World Cup, but. The majority of me believes in this group, believes in this coach, and believes when their backs are against the wall, you'll see the best version of them. I hope I'm right. I hope I'm right. And I hope the next time we talk, Tad Potters, it will be celebratory and not sad. Talk to you then. And until then, you guys, stay on your feet.